Okay, we want to spend a little time this morning in this plenary really saying, as we start this final deliberative and deciding phase, really remind us what we really need to do in this process and where we're at. And that involves, I think, saying something about that so we can help focus, remind ourselves then of the basic features on which we are really going to have to make some decisions, then do some consideration of the underlying dynamics that will influence choices and decisions, and then get on with those choices. So let's start by reminding ourselves of the mandate. It's fairly clear and specific, and I know that in all your responses to Jack, you talked a lot about the importance to focus. And it's pretty clear in the order in council. We have to assess models for electing members of the Legislative Assembly. So how are members elected to the Assembly? And issue a report recommending whether the current model should be retained or whether another model must be adopted. So that's fairly clear. It's fairly definitive in terms of what needs to be done. Is this going to work? That task really involves a number of points when we break it down. These italicized bits are taken exactly then from the mandate as well in the order in council. That assessment of those models is meant to be limited to the manner in which voters' ballots are translated into seats in the assembly. So other aspects that we might think are part of the electoral system are beyond the mandate. The mandate says not only must we assess the way those things work, the way that election translation happens, but we then also have to, in our assessment, well, your assessment, not mine, take into account the potential effect of the model on the system of government. So in some sense, it's a two-part assessment. The first part is on the politics and the election process. But the assessment has to go beyond that to what I think Ian McKinnon yesterday called the back end and talk about the impact on government. So it's a really two-pronged kind of assessment process. If you, at the end of that process, decide that we need a recommendation for change, that recommendation must fulfill two requirements. Again, this is all part of the mandate which the Assembly members have accepted. First of all, it has to be consistent with the Constitution of Canada, and because if it isn't, it'll be ruled unconstitutional by the courts, and all the work will come to a naught. Secondly, it has to be consistent with the Westminster parliamentary system. And here, of course, we had some debate. Campbell was sort of right last night, and I was more right. And Ian talked a little bit about that and how, in some sense, that system will, in its narrowest conception, have to change a little bit. But it really speaks to a kind of a system in which governments are responsible, the legislature, and so on. But if we also make a recommendation, that the model that you recommend must be described clearly and in detail. I underline that part because that's kind of the scary part. It's one thing to say, oh, well, we ought to have a proportional system or a none-of-the-above system or some other system. But then you have to go beyond that and describe clearly so people understand it and in detail so people would know exactly what they're voting for, what that model would look like. And that's where a fair amount of work would need to be done even once you've made basic kinds of decisions. Now let's remind ourselves of what the Assembly has already said about this process before. This is all I was horrified to discover when I read the preliminary report, all one sentence. It's a long sentence. But the Assembly started off by recognizing that British Columbia had operated as a pretty flourishing democracy in which parties and governments were held accountable and were elected and re-elected and removed as voters chose. And that abandoning such a system, which had served this province well for over 100 years, would be a significant change. And you wouldn't want to do that, so you said, unless it was clear that the system had some real deficiencies which detracted from the effective and efficient and healthy working of democratic politics in British Columbia. So we're not going to change for the sake of it. We're going to change, you say, only if you recognize some deficiencies. But recognizing deficiencies doesn't seem to be good enough, right? Because you have to find an alternative that will speak to those deficiencies. No sense saying, well, this doesn't work and that doesn't work, so let's change it. You only want to change it if what you're proposing, in fact, would appear to speak to those and maybe remedy some of those kind of deficiencies. So the assembly has basically kind of staked out that ground in terms of how it sees its mandate in its preliminary statement. Of course, it's not entirely bound by it, but it seems a kind of reasonable position from reasonable people. So in some sense, we're left with a series of, at the end of the day, a series of questions that the assembly kind of needs to answer. Really, are there problems with the current system? Are you, as members, convinced that there are significant problems? Well, and if there are, do we actually know what they are? I mean, are we clear about what they are, or is it just a kind of generalized discontent? So if there are problems, what are they? And if there are issues that we can identify, is there an alternative that would identify some of those kinds of issues? If there's an alternative that identify those issues, how would it work and what new problems will it create? Because it will have some kind of consequences. It will change the pattern of government and politics. And what would be those consequences? And then, I suppose, the logical follow-up, will the cure be worse than the disease? One always has to think about when you decide to kind of cure something. Is a mustard pack on your face worse than having a cough? You have to make those kind of decisions. So ultimately, that's really the logic, it seems to me, of the kind of questions that you're now facing. Well, we heard yesterday that there really are two very different kind of perspectives on the electoral systems, and in fact, they kind of reflect those two parts of the task that we have in terms of assessment, to assess the impact of voters and then assess the impact on government. And there's one series of perspectives that thinks about elections in terms of voters and representation in the electoral process. What system provides best for democratic representation? How can elections work most fairly? How can interests be represented? How can different voices be heard in the electoral process? And a good deal of what you've read about electoral systems talks in those kinds of terms. But there's another whole series of perspectives on the electoral process that says, wait a minute, elections are a kind of means to an end, and the end is kind of democratic governance. And so what we really want to think about is elections not in terms of representation and the mechanisms of the contest, but what are the consequences for a democratic government that kind of works. And those often come down to questions about stable government, majority government, and the relationship between the legislature and the government and the role of MLAs in governing, and those kinds of things. What I think Ian McKinnon called the back end. Well, when you think about it, the people who mostly talk about proportional representation mostly talk about that kind of first perspective. That's in some sense where they're giving priority. And I think we heard it yesterday from Mr. Halser and Ms. Gordon and Mayor Mori in a different kind of way. All really talking about representational, electoral perspectives. That's what was kind of driving them. The kind of perspectives that were driving McKinnon and Nielsen were really much more from the government kind of end. What are the consequences for government and the way the legislature and the government interacts? And by and large, those kinds of people are more sympathetic to the majority plurality perspectives. Not to say they advocate them, but in some sense, part of the debate between those two kinds of perspectives reflects these different perspectives on the electoral system. And the challenge, in some sense, of course, is to provide for some kind of balanced perspective. What do we think are the, what do you think are the priorities? And how do those things need to get weighed up? Well, as we start this, let's have a couple of cautionary reminders. As a number of people said yesterday, and I probably even said it once or twice, there is no perfect electoral system. That all of them involve some kind of trade-offs between desirable characteristics. That you can't have everything. If you want more of something, you may have to give up something else. It's worth reminding ourselves that changing the electoral system is not going to fix everything in our society. It's only one element of a large, complex political system, which involves norms around the Constitution and rules in the Constitution, and involves the place of the courts in the system, and it involves the government-legislative relationships. And the electoral process is one piece of that, but it's only a piece. And we're not reinventing our entire democratic social order. We're looking at one particular piece. It will have some consequences, but it's not going to fix everything. It's probably worth remembering, I think, as one of the people said yesterday, I think it was Catherine Gordon, that politics is not going to stop being adversarial. I mean, politics is about division. It's about competing views of the good society and about competing views about the way we get there. And so by its very nature, it's adversarial. And one might have systems that change the style and tone and the balance of those forces. But at the end of the day, changing an electoral system is going to change the way in which these contests play themselves out. But it's not going to end, not going to change the world and make politics suddenly a cooperative, non-adversarial process. In a society in which there are legitimate and healthy and deeply felt divisions of opinion on important issues. It's probably true that what everyone thinks, political parties are not going to go away. We know of no mass democracy in which there are not political parties organizing an electoral process. And as long as we engage in electoral politics and voters in large numbers are appealed to for their support, political parties or organizations that look like them will exist. We have yet to invent some other kind of process. So they're not going to go away. There's no immediate prospect of that. And so that whatever we're talking about, it's going to be a process which is going to involve political parties. Oh, I don't know what that happened. We lost the screen. The second reality probably is that party discipline is not going to end. We lost the whole computer. That party discipline is really, in some sense, the point of political parties. People come together to organize, to form groups, to advocate their particular positions, and you can't do that unless you kind of agree to work together. And in some sense, discipline is the tool by which people are held together and work. So the amount and the character and the interplay of party discipline may alter and work in different systems, but it isn't going to disappear. It's part of the whole point of having political parties in the first place. And finally, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that whatever changes we introduce are going to produce consequences that are not entirely predictable. That it's not always possible. We know that if you change the electoral system, there will be consequences for the kinds of parties we have, the number of parties, how they compete, the impact in the governing process. What those consequences are is extremely difficult to predict. And I have actually an excellent slide, which is going to illustrate two quite conflicting ways in which that may play itself out in 1.3 minutes. No? Not a chance? Okay. We got it up here. Do we know what happened? Went to sleep. Give me one of my talks that went to sleep. I can't believe it. God has done it again. 9 o'clock in the morning. Boy, you'd have to hurt a guy. Okay. And here's a kind of attempt to have a simple illustration of what might happen. We now have a system in which we have kind of two parties that compete with one another. They stand up there and they compete, and one side wins votes and one side's another vote. And we have two parties partly because we have this kind of single-member plurality, winner-take-all system that discourages the small parties, that keeps them out of the legislature even when they win votes. We know all that kind of stuff. And their incentive is to maintain enough differentiation to hold their voters and maybe to steal a few from the other side. But if we change the system in a way that perhaps increases the number of political parties, what will the consequences be? Can we predict? Can we be sure? I think it's very difficult. We can think of just two very simple kinds of alternatives. Let's say we double the number of parties, and two of the smaller parties now get into the legislature. There could be more. And here's two kinds of alternatives. We've got these neat red arrows. We learned how to put red arrows on grass this week. If the two parties are between the two big parties, if they're two small centrist kinds of parties, one would see that the big parties would have some kind of incentive to move towards them, to engage them in a coalition. So party one up there might have an incentive to try and attract parties two and three to join them in a coalition. So might party four. It would try and attract parties two and three. And so that would, might be a dynamic in which parties would, in fact, the large parties might be pulled together. They would compete for the support of parties two and three and would try and work with them. And so you could imagine a kind of more accommodative coalition style of politics emerging when you had that kind of center-seeking force. So there'd be a kind of accommodative increase. If, on the other hand, the small parties were outside, let's say you had a, you've got the New Democrats here, and if you had a more extreme left-wing party out on that side, more extreme right-wing party beyond the Liberals, those big parties might be pulled farther apart as they tried to seek the support, the coalition bargains of these smaller parties, if they needed their support to form a coalition. And the more parties you have in the legislature, the less likely any of them will have a majority. So you could imagine, depending on the positioning, that in fact the larger parties would be pulled farther apart. There could be increased polarization, increased adversarial dynamics in the system. And in fact, there's likely to be some combination of the two, with a couple of parties perhaps between the big parties, some on the outsides. And the range of alternative dynamics is quite unpredictable and might vary from election to election. Some of this process would take place before election, some would take after. What we don't know is exactly what it would look like. And both those scenarios seem quite likely in British Columbia. Either of them is quite a likely possibility, but they would change the dynamics of our province's politics in quite different kinds of ways. And we don't know which way that might be. So it's that kind of uncertainty and perhaps unintended consequences that could easily play itself out. Well, as you are engaged in the process of having to make decisions, remember you have to describe clearly and in detail an electoral system, if you're going to recommend one, you have to make recommendations about three dimensions, three principal dimensions. And that's going to involve some kind of trade-offs amongst these decisions. Some will be explicit, more will be implicit. Questions about voter choice. And we know they're largely concerned with the nature and extent of the choices that voters have at the ballot box. What do those things look like? Because voters are going to go into a ballot, in a voting place. They're going to be faced with a ballot paper that will have some kinds of choices. What kinds? How will they be organized? An electoral system has to make some decision about the basis for representation, whether it's partisan or geographic or whatever. And that's the question of local representation in some sense, because we're going to be assessing it against a system which is now claimed to have a fair amount of local representation. And that's about whether you recognize and incorporate the geographic dimensions of social and political life into an electoral system, or you just say they're not relevant. And finally, the other dimension on which you ultimately have to make some decisions will be about proportionality. And of course, proportionality is a notion that gives primacy to the partisan system-wide basis for electoral organization and competition. Well, I don't know whether this wants to work. Well, let me say a little bit about voter choice. I will say something about those three things as a reminder of those kind of dimensions on which one has to make decisions. Voter choice, at the end of the day, is largely determined by the number and nature of the competing parties and the candidates they put up. The way those choices are organized and structured and how one, as a voter, can respond to them may vary. But ultimately, the important dynamic will be how many political parties are out there, how many candidates are putting themselves forward, and in what kind of combination. And that means that a good deal of the essentials of the reality of voter choice is in some sense beyond our mandate, because it is about that whole process of people putting themselves forward. The electoral system doesn't govern how many people can do that and the ways they can do it. And so the party's nomination processes are key at some level to the kinds of options voters have. If only two parties compete, the range of choices is going to be very different than a 43 or 41 or however many registered parties we have in BC now. Compete. Of course, we know that things like preferential ballots and open lists attempt to increase the amount of choice, in some sense by transferring some of that power from the parties and the nominators to the voters. And that's the point of those kinds of ballots. And we know that different kinds of ballot structures can provide for a wide range of different choices. Within any family, different ballot structures can provide for different kind of choices, but they're always constrained by the logic of the basic electoral system. So that a single transferable vote system has a kind of logic which says these are the kind of kinds of choices you can have. The plurality system constrains it as well. And we've talked about some of that kind of thing. The typical ballot forms across our five families are something like this. We know, and while there's variation, these are in some sense the typical patterns. It's just kind of trying to remind ourselves. In plurality systems, it's a kind of simple X or a tick or a choice. Majority systems, the logic of them is to suggest that people can rank candidates on the kind of 1, 2, 3. Ballot paper looks exactly the same, basically. The kind of choices in a single transferable vote system, that's a system which encourages people to rank candidates. Not parties, but rank candidates in this kind of order. PR list systems tell voters in the audience, indicate the parties, not the candidates, the parties they prefer by selecting a list. They can sometimes choose a candidate, but we know in list systems, even when they choose a candidate, they're really choosing a party. Because it's going to be the party that candidate belongs to that's going to get the vote first. And only if that party gets enough of them will those candidate votes then begin to count. And we know in a mixed system, there's often two choices that are involved. Sometimes plurality or a majority type ballot for the constituency part of the mixture, and some kind of list voting on the proportional representation kind of component. In all these systems, of course, the none of the above alternative is quite viable. You could have none of the above on the ballot paper in any of these kinds of families. And of course, if one then moves to that kind of alternative on a ballot, which is compatible with any of them, then the question becomes, well, if people vote for it, then what happens? We know that in places like Russia now, they have another election. But there have been suggestions, and some have been made to the assembly, that, of course, well, then you just say, well, we're not going to have any more elections. We're going to choose people randomly. So if you go for a kind of a none of the above on a ballot form, then you have the then what happens a kind of question to deal with. Either move on to another election or to something completely different. This thing doesn't seem to fit through me. Local representation. Well, let's remind ourselves a little bit about that dimension that we need to speak about. Ultimately, systems that give some kind of primacy to local representation assumes that the geography is the fundamental basis, that the social organization in geographic communities is what's important, and it's important because that's what provides a clear, identifiable link between voters and politicians. And the other logic for that really is that ensures that all areas, geographic areas of the province, have an identified representative. Now, the big question in local representation is, well, does party discipline make a mockery of all this stuff? I mean, if members have to go to the legislature and vote the party line, what does that tell us about local representation? What does it mean? Are they genuinely local representatives anymore? Some would argue, well, no. Party discipline really negates that. The other alternative is to say, well, it still means that local areas have some say. And in fact, when we want to think about what are disciplined parties anyway? Well, they're collections of people who have agreed to be bound by the same decision. And so that what local representation would do, even in the context of party discipline, is ensure that all voices go into the decision, which is then imposed by discipline on the members. So that political parties, in fact, are made up, or caucuses and legislatures are made up, at the end of the day, of local representatives. You know, there's not a lot of Western voice in the Bloc Québécois in Ottawa. Not surprising. There's not much Quebec voice in the Conservative Party caucus in Ottawa, because there's no members from that part of the country. So it's a kind of interesting conceptual trade between, you know, does party discipline kind of make the notion of local representation moot, or in fact does party discipline ensure that the voices of those locales that are in the caucus in some sense get primacy in that party's general decision making? Of course, there's the other whole side of local representation, which doesn't focus on the voting in the legislature side, but focuses on the role of the MLA as a kind of local ombudsperson, serving the constituents, someone that people can go to, the conduit to government, so that when you need something and you need access, whether it's a passport or concern for mad cow disease or whatever, there's a representative you can go to who knows that they depend on your support to be elected. And that's a whole function, a whole side of the local representative process that really is kind of independent of the party voting in the legislature question to begin with. And finally, one might want to think about, what does local representation in multi-member districts mean? Is it the same kind of thing? And so when you talk about when we talk about local representation in districts, does it work differently if it's a single-member district or a multi-member district? Some people would argue that the single transferable vote is almost, there's too much local representation because people are arguing with people in their own party to service local constituents. On the other hand, if you have multi-member districts like in Vancouver, people here are now arguing that there's not enough local representation in Vancouver, even though they're all elected by the plurality rule, and they want to go to single-member systems. So the amount of local representation may be partly a function of the rule, but it may also be a function of whether we're in single or multi-member districts. And so if you begin to think about that as an important characteristic, you have to ask yourself, well, it's going to work differently in a multi-member district than a single-member district. Probably does. In a very simple, generalized way, we could kind of rank, I suppose, these families along a kind of continuum from lots of local representation to fairly low. And I suppose traditionally political scientists would say the systems that provide for the most localized kind of politics are probably the single transferable vote. The systems that provide for the least are the pure nationwide proportional representation systems. Israel, the Netherlands being the kind of classic case where there are no districts whatsoever in the whole country. So there's where you're going to have the least. Majority and plurality probably rank about there. And mixed systems are very difficult to say because one of the points of a mixed system is that you can produce different kinds of combinations so there can be more or less. Might depend on how many constituencies there were, how big they were, what the rule was, it a plurality or majority rule within them, whether the PR part of the list was kind of system-wide or regionalized. So that can move quite a long way along that continuum in terms of where you want to organize it. Oh, we're getting too far away from this machine to make this little clicker work. Okay, let me just say a little bit about the third dimension, proportionality. And we all know that that's basically about this idea that the share of votes should somehow be connected to the share of seats at the end of the day when the elections are counted up. This suggests, of course, that you need to think about elections as British Columbia-wide, not a series of contests in individual districts, but elections are really, they're British Columbia elections. They're not elections in Surrey and Prince George North and Okanagan, Vernon, and so on. And so you take the sum of all the votes, and that ought to somehow get to the sum of all the seats. Now, we know that that's a kind of abstract notion, because in the real world, no system is perfectly proportional. And there's a whole series of reasons, and they have to do with, the mathematics of it. District magnitudes make a difference. Where proportionality is assigned? Is it decided on a province-wide basis or a regional basis? And then, in fact, how do you then allocate the seats? You can have the decision to make the province proportional, but in fact do the proportional allocation regionally, or you can have only regions that organize proportionally. So there's that's likely to change it. If there are some thresholds, that's a way of saying, well, it's going to be proportional for everybody except for these small guys. So that's one of the constraints on proportionality. The kind of formula used. In a mixed system, how much of the system is proportional, and whether you have overhang seats and so on. All those kinds of things can alter the amount of proportionality, and none of it's likely to get to exactly perfect. But the closest you can get is in the Netherlands or Israel. I think the Netherlands, if you get 0.67% of a vote, you get a seat. And that's because of the size of the Netherlands Parliament, 150 seats. Well, in proportional systems, like most other systems, all these things add up to meaning the largest party usually gets some little advantage, much less than they do in other systems, but there is some kind of advantage. And we know that different kinds of thresholds can produce advantages for different kinds of parties, and we saw that in New Zealand, where they have some constituency thresholds and some just numerical thresholds, and those work in different kinds of ways. So proportionality, you really want to think of it as a kind of relative kind of condition. You can have more or less of it. In some sense, you can have more or less compensation for distortions. And in some level, the question really comes down to how much consideration should be given to the consideration of making sure that smaller parties are represented, the parties that won't get represented in a plurality or majority system. A little bit or a lot, where the kind of the most you can get to is approaching that so-called perfect proportionality. Well, we know again on one of these continuums from a lot of proportionality to very little, the systems kind of tend to line up more or less like this. At the most proportional are the least PR systems that are nationwide or system-wide. The least proportional are likely to be majority systems because, in fact, they get because of the incentives at local districts. But plurality and majority are going to be there at that end. Mixed and single transferable vote systems, again, are likely to be somewhere in the middle, and it's difficult to pin them down on that continuum because they can move along it depending on district magnitudes and thresholds and quotas and all those kinds of things, and it will be considerably influenced by the number of parties that are running as well. So the extent of proportionality can be varied partly to taste and partly to design, but it's also partly going to reflect the number of competitors and how they compete. So not entirely controllable. A whole side issue, which we haven't talked about. I knew you'd want to have to talk about something we hadn't talked about yet. The mandate says we have to talk about the electoral process. We've mostly talked about electoral process in the context of general elections. But what happens when a seat becomes vacant? You know, some member retires, or is appointed to the Senate, or becomes a judge, or gets hit by a bus, or, you know, any of these things that happen to people. Our electoral system, or your electoral system, needs to provide for that possibility. And all electoral systems have to provide for what happens when, between general elections, seats become vacant. What's the process by which those people are replaced? And so in describing in detail, as you have to, a system, you're going to have some provision for that. And there's a whole variety of options. I know you'd want to have lots of choices. And, of course, there are. And those provisions will have different implications for the rules for the general election. These are the general patterns that you see out there when you look at the families. In plurality systems, we have generally a local by-election. We're all familiar with that. We have them in our kind of system. Majority systems tend to work the same way. The logic is much the same. In some countries, however, they say, look, rather than going to the trouble and expense of a by-election, when there's actually a general election, there's a candidate who's chosen, but every candidate has an alternate whose name is on the ballot. And so when you're voting for that candidate, you're also voting for the alternate. And if for some reason the candidate gets knocked off or pushed out, that alternate will take their place. You could do, of course, that with a plurality system. I don't know of any that do it. The French use that for their majority system because, of course, they use a two-round system, and that would get really cumbersome for by-elections. Single transferable votes tend to have two kinds of options. One is to have a local by-election. Now, if you have a local by-election and a single transferable vote, what you're really having is a majority election, aren't you? Because suddenly it's only a one-candidate election. Single transferable votes based on the logic of multi-member districts, if there's only one person being elected, it's kind of turned into a majority election for the purpose of that by-election. That's what the Irish use. In Tasmania, as our friend would tell us, they essentially go back to the original ballots and kind of continue the count. And then choose the next person who would have been elected. Of course, what happens in that situation is then parties have to make sure they actually nominate more candidates than they think they're going to get elected, just in case any of them are needed if someone dies. So there are consequences for that kind of by-election process for the nomination strategy in the general election process. Isn't this fun? I love this stuff. Okay, PR list systems we know is basically pretty straightforward. You go to the next name on the list. And that's how almost all of them work. Mixed systems, because they're mixed, are a little bit more complicated. Traditionally, the system we have, they have two kinds of mechanisms. For the list part, they simply go to the next name on the list. There's no by-election. for the constituency part, they say, oh, it's the constituency part, we'll have a by-election in that one by whatever rules they elected that part of the system. So depending on whether you were a list member or a constituency member, the vacancy replacement provisions are quite different. Now, you can immediately see that that will have implications for parties. Anyone you think you might want to appoint to the Senate or some other important, you know, Valhalla for politicians, you make sure they get elected on the list, because then if you appoint them before the next general election, you don't have to have a by-election. You can just go to the next person on the list. And we could point to important people who've done that. Okay, so we know our electoral systems fall into these big kinds of categories. And ultimately, because voter choice is a function of ballots, and you can alter ballots in different kind of systems, in some sense that comes after you decide what kind of system you have, and you say, okay, now what kind of choices within that family do we want? They tend to fall into these big choices around local representation and proportionality. And if we think of our five families, you can see that all of them provide for some kind of local representation, except for list PR systems. That kind of local representation will be different. In a mixed system, it will be limited to some number of seats. In a single transferable vote system, it will be within the context of a multi-member district. In plurality and majority systems, it will look more or less like we have it now. The kind of voter choice you can have will vary. All systems except for really list systems, PR, really essentially provide for choice of candidates. Voters can express preferences for parties in party list systems and in mixed systems sometimes, and in single transferable vote systems. So you see there's various kinds of combinations. If you're in a non-proportional system, you don't get to vote for a party. You know, you're voting for candidates in local districts, and there's no efficient way to do that. So that's basically the kind of framework within which we're operating in terms of these three basic kinds of conditions. Okay, so all you have to do is decide all that, describe a system, and you're done. These are the kinds of decisions you'll probably have to wrestle with to provide that description. If you're going to say, the present system is the best of all possible worlds, we'd never want to change it, there's not many decisions to be made. You might want to make some fine-tuning about perhaps the ballot structure or, I don't know what. Introduce a none-of-the-above alternative. But very little to do. If you want to move to a majority system, the kind of system Mr. DeSantis was talking about yesterday, what he described as that low-risk, you don't get much, but you don't lose much system, you'd have to provide for preferential ballots. And what would they look like, and what would the structure around those would be, and what would the transfer rules be? You know, how would you do the transfers, and those are technical. Or you'd have to provide for a runoff if you didn't want to have votes being transferred to go to the kind of the French version. So limited number of decisions if you go down those routes. If you go down the single transferable route, you'd have to make some fundamental decisions about district magnitudes, how big they should be. And should they be the same all across the province, or would you want them to vary? And if they were to vary, on kind of what criteria? There'd need to be some rules about the way that voters fill out the ballots. Could they vote 1, 2, 3, or just 1 if they wanted, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or whatever. In Ireland, voters can vote as many preferences as they want. 1, 2, they can stop any point in Tasmania, you need to fill out the whole list. And you could have in-between combinations if you want. You'd have to make some decisions about the quotas. And you'd have to make some decisions about the transfer rules under which votes are transferred. And that becomes all technical stuff, but it can make a difference sometimes. And, of course, you have to make some provision for what happens if a member of the legislature is no longer there. How do you replace them? How do you provide for an empty seat? So that's basically the kind of set of decisions that would be involved in describing a single transferable vote system. If you wanted to go to the PR list route, you'd have to make it a series of decisions, starting with the questions about the ballot form. Would it be an open list or a closed list? And if it was an open list, what would that look like and how would it be organized? And there's an infinite variety of those, I suppose. Make some decisions about seat allocation rules. Do you want to make proportionality on a province-wide basis or perhaps a regional basis? And no matter which you decide on that, how then did you want to actually assign the proportional seats? First of all, you have to decide who's going to get them, and then you have to assign them. And those are separate kind of phenomenon. What kind of formula or quota would you use to calculate proportionality? And, you know, we know that if you get 45% of the vote, you should get about 45% of the seats. That's the logic. But formula and quota really, in the end, address who's going to get the last two or three seats. They make a difference at the margin, so you'd have to make some decision. We know that the Saint-Legault formula works differently than the Drew quota and all that stuff. You know, that's the fun part. We'd have to make some decision about that. There'd have to be some decision about thresholds. Do you want any? What would they look like? How would they be organized? And, again, questions about seat vacancies. And finally, if you go to a mixed system, because it's mixed and because you're trying to combine different kinds of systems, there'd be more decisions to be taken. First of all, is it a supplementary, so-called MMM system, or a complementary one that aims to produce overall proportionality? Remember, the first are the kind the Japanese now use and many of the Eastern Europeans. The latter, the complementary ones, are the New Zealand, German-style systems. What would the balance between list and local members be in your mixed system? And we know that has a real impact on the kind of proportionality. Some decisions about candidate eligibility rules. Could candidates run on both the list and in constituencies? Real consequences for the way the parties work and the kind of competition in a decision of that sort. Would voters have one or two ballots? Many mixed systems, you get to vote for a party and a candidate, but some of them work where you just vote for a candidate and those get summed up to party votes. The Germans used that for a while, one ballot system, then they shifted to a two ballot system. So, and in Quebec, they're wrestling with that kind of a question. And there are real consequences for the extent to which parties can maybe manipulate and cheat a little bit in that decision. Then there'd be a whole series of decisions about the candidate seats, which would be the kind of decisions that we'd have in a plurality majority system, a whole series of decisions about list seats and all the kind of decisions you'd make in list systems. So there'd be lots of decisions to be required to describe clearly what that kind of system would look like. And finally, of course, what would be the seat vacancy provisions for both types of seats. So in fact, that's the kind of the working agenda like you guys got. Making decisions about those things so you could describe an alternative clearly and in some detail. Oh, you're so lucky. It's so much fun. Well, we know that, really, just to kind of bring us back to the general level thinking about this stuff, we know that the electoral system dynamics play out through the governing process. First of all, they have a considerable impact on the way elections are organized. They help define what we mean by democratic representation. What's the basis for that representation? And define the outcomes of elections. We know that the electoral system has a good deal of impact on the kind of parties we have and the character of party competition. And finally, we know that it plays itself out in the structuring of the legislature and the relationships between parliamentary government and the legislature that creates and holds that government accountable, if it's able to. The most powerful contrast along these three big kind of issues, many of which people were talking about it in different ways yesterday, is really ultimately between these proportional and non-proportional systems. And if we think about the elections process for a minute, proportional systems are really based on the idea that the real choice is between representation is a question of representing partisan interests. Representation is ultimately about representing political parties. Non-proportional systems say, no, representation is about the expression of geographic interests in the legislature. It's geographically organized communities that are represented, not parties' interests. And at the end of the day, you know, the systems are really saying representation is about those two kind of different sorts of things. That in proportional systems, voters are ultimately choosing a party. No matter how the ballot is structured at the end, you know, what really counts at the end of the day is a party. And that's what voters' fundamental choice is about. In non-proportional systems, their fundamental choice is for a candidate. No matter how those candidates are gathered together in political parties, no matter how they're affiliated, ultimately the voters get a choice about a candidate. In terms of elections, how do we think about election outcomes? The proportional systems are saying, look, at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters is the bottom line, the total score. You get so many votes, you should get so many seats. non-proportional system saying, well, no, elections are more subtle than that. They are really about a series of contests. And the outcome of election is the result of the outcome of all these separate individual contests in these geographically different places. And the example I sometimes use is, it's the kind of the total goals versus total games kind of metaphor for the Stanley Cup. We could organize a Stanley Cup in which people played seven games and the team that scored the most goals won the cup. Or we could say, no, the team that wins the most games wins the cup, even if they get fewer goals. You know, Calgary, during the last Stanley Cup series, I think it was in the third round, won the round but got fewer goals. Right? The other two, I think it was Detroit, outscored them. But they won the series because they... So, like, how do you think about that? What's the defining way in which you think about what's the appropriate character of outcomes? And these systems, say, provide different answers. And finally, the systems say something about what kind of election results we ought to have. Proportional systems say party seat shares ought to reflect their vote shares. Non-proportional systems say, no, local parties, because they've won more contests, are going to be overrepresented, and that's not a bad thing. So that's the kind of different dynamics that are working at the electoral process. When we think about party competition, we know that, again, in a general way, and we're talking about kind of general patterns here, proportional systems facilitate multi-party competition by making it easier for small parties to compete and making sure that they get some reward for their efforts. Non-proportional systems tend to encourage two-party competition. Now, part of the way they encourage it, of course, is by discouraging small parties. You know, you beat people over the head enough times and they'll say, well, I don't like this anymore. I'm going to go do something else. And the electoral equivalent of beating over the head is saying, you can get 10, 20% of the vote, but we're not giving you any seats. And maybe after a while people say, well, okay, maybe we'll join a bigger party and work within that. So that's the kind of the logic of non-proportional systems. So whether you call it encouraging two-party competition or penalizing small parties, it amounts to the same thing. In proportional systems, you tend to get more parties in, and they tend to be more differentiated from one another because they've got to carve out some kind of identifiable space. In non-proportional systems, you tend to get fewer parties, and they're more broadly based because they're broader, wider coalitions of a range of different kind of interests that otherwise might have created their own smaller parties. Party organization in proportional systems tends to be more centralized, partly because the kind of the list arrangements that generates proportionality facilitates more centralized decision making and making lists and all the rest, and focuses on the party as a total organization. Party organization in non-proportional systems tends to be much more decentralized. Local contests are fought in local communities, and local communities are probably more efficient at figuring out what's going to work for them. So parties say, well, we'll let the people in Prince George North kind of organize themselves because they know what's going to sell in their kind of community. And so there is a kind of differentiation in terms of the amount of centralization, decentralization, generally speaking, in these systems. Now, of course, some kinds of parties vary quite a lot, but that's a kind of general pattern that follows from the logic of how these systems work. Not surprisingly, in proportional systems, parties tend to make more narrow, focused appeals. You know, if they know that they can win their 10% of the vote appealing to the, you know, the marijuana Marxists, they're going to carve out that area and say, all marijuana Marxists ought to vote for us. And if you're not one, you know, vote for somebody else. So there's a sense when you're creating more parties, you've got to have more brand differentiation, to use that kind of market analogy. When you've only got a couple of parties and they're trying to appeal to a much broader base to win a majority or a large plurality of votes, they tend to be much more diffuse, what political scientists call catch-all parties. They become big vote vacuum machines. They'll suck anything in that they can, and to do that they have to have a big kind of, you know, sucking machine. And elections at the end of the day in proportional systems, because a lot of parties are going to get elected, tend to be ones in which voters get a chance to express their political preferences, vote for what they really believe in. And elections become opportunities for the electorate to kind of display the range of political preferences. In non-proportional systems, they become much harder People have to make strategic calculations because only a couple of parties are likely to win seats. They often have to vote for their second or third choice or against somebody. And those kind of elections tend to become harder contests to choose governments. So people in elections, you get a choice of kind of choosing a government or expressing your preferred political preference. And again, there's a kind of logic to these systems that is based there. And finally, in terms of parliamentary government, and here we come nearly to the end, there is another kind of dynamic. Proportional systems produce legislatures that have more political parties in them. That's the point of having a proportional system. So there are more parties with larger shares of seats in the legislature. Non-proportional systems tend to have a much smaller number of parties that have any significant number of seats in the legislature. So you've got legislatures that are going to look very different. You know, Elizabeth MacLay told us about, you know, the old New Zealand pattern. There were two big parties, sometimes the odd social creditor. Odd in both senses, I guess, in New Zealand Parliament. Now there are seven or eight parties. And so the legislature looks differently, and so it's going to work differently. And its relationship with the government is going to be different. In proportional systems, we're likely to have, much more likely to have minority governments or multi-party coalitions formed by politicians after the elections. Sometimes if the system polarizes, as one of my little examples suggests, sometimes it's clear what those things are likely to be, but since no one exactly knows who's going to have how many seats after the election and whether you're actually going to need a coalition partner, often the hard decisions about coalitions do get created and governments get decided after elections when people actually know who has how many seats. In non-proportional systems, more often than not, you tend to get single-party majorities based on election victories. Election victories, of course, that are the creation partly of the electoral system that gives those majority parties more seats than the votes might otherwise indicate. In terms of cabinet durability, certainly minority governments tend to have a shorter life. Coalition governments can be about the same once the system stabilizes. And there, the rules or the experience varies quite a lot by different kinds of countries. Some countries, of course, have fixed election dates and so on. But by and large, I think it's probably fair to say that at least minorities are going to be shorter than in non-proportional systems. Coalitions depend quite a lot on the kind of the coalition style and on the rules for forming coalition governments. If it's easy to change the coalition, it's more likely to change. If it's much harder in the parliament to change the coalition, those coalitions tend to have a longer life. So the kind of rules that Ian McKinnon was talking about yesterday might have to change would have some kind of impact on that sort of thing. How much check on the government does the legislature provide? Well, basically, under parliamentary systems, it's relatively limited on either side. More in a proportional system will depend on the coalition balance and how disciplined the coalition parties are, how the committees are used. But at least there's a vehicle there in parliamentary committees. Governments don't always, or any single party doesn't always have a majority, so more work is likely to be done in committees. In fact, some of the kind of bill-by-bill coalition balancing trade-offs may well take place in committees. There's almost, I say little, but almost no legislative control of the government in non-proportional systems. So if there's a disciplined backbench, opposition members are politically relatively impotent. They can make a row and shout at people like Jim Nielsen if they want. But, you know, it doesn't change what he wants to do. And finally, in terms of legislative membership, an issue that I know a number of people are concerned about, in proportional systems, there's a mechanism through party control of lists and so on for party leaders to have a greater chance of establishing a representative membership, however they define that. They want to have more left-handed people or more political scientists in their caucus. They can do that. In non-proportional systems, the kind of the content and the makeup of the legislature is really the sum total of a whole series of more decentralized local decisions. And so it's much less controllable or shapeable in that sense. Okay, so here we come. Here you go. The question before the Assembly then is whether there's an alternate system that would foster a different set of dynamics. Along those, and those things we were talking about are kind of opposite ends of continuums. And elections and party competition and legislative government relations, all that 10 or 12 things I've just kind of raced us through really represent a kind of continuum, and systems can fall on any of those dimensions somewhere along them. But is there a different electoral system that might move us, or might move the province in a way that would replace the dynamics we have now that people might think would be desirable. And the way to answer that question might be by starting to say, well, what features, what political dynamics would be best for British Columbia? Would it be better if we had more legislative control of the government, if we had more parties, and so on? And if we can kind of identify some of those features and rank them, then we can we'll have identified what it is we want, and then if we figure that out, we can begin to say, okay, what electoral system is going to get us there? But that really means kind of trying to decide what is it about the dynamics of our elections and our political competition and our governing relationships as expressed through a parliamentary system that we want, and can we identify them? Well, I suggest that going back to those 12 or 14 things, we can kind of reduce them to a number of kind of key ones. Do we want MLAs chosen to represent a specific local constituency, however local be defined? Multi-member, single member, different kinds of ways. Do voters want an opportunity to vote for both preferred candidates and parties, or is it really about voting for a party or voting for a candidate? How closely should seats won mirror votes won? Is that really an issue? Do we want to, you know, make sure that small parties get a little bit of representation? Do we want to go the whole hog? Do we want a system that actually encourages more parties in the legislature, that ultimately then would produce a legislature which wouldn't have majority governments? Do we want elections that will decide who forms governments, or do we want elections that allow us to express basically the range of political preferences held by citizens? Do we want a stronger role for individual MLAs? Is there an electoral system that would facilitate and strengthen that kind of role? Do we want a legislature that looks different, that looks more like British Columbians than the one we have now? Do we want a system of single-party majority governments? And I would have thought that if you can answer how important those kinds of things are, and you can't have them all, there's trade-offs amongst them in terms of what an electoral system could be. If you could identify the two or three that were most important, you'll have gone a long way to identifying which kind of electoral system family you want to zero in on as a possible alternative to the system we have now. So what I'm going to suggest in discussion groups is for you to think about, of that list that I just had up there of 8 features, can you identify 3 of them that are the most important? Even if they may be mutually contradictory. You know, can you get as far as saying, okay, we have to decide these 3 are the most important of those 8. Are any of them just not important at all? Is there one that we could just kind of write off? And do we know why we made those decisions? So if your discussion group could say, we think these are the 3 most important things, the 3 most important elements, the 3 features of BC politics we would like to see the most, and maybe here's one that we could care less about, I think the members would have gone a long way as to say, okay, what are the underlying political dynamics we want to have in the province? And then, okay, logically, what kind of electoral system does that lead us to? So I guess that's really, in some sense, a task for discussion groups. What we hope is that in the discussion groups, you kind of wrestle with that list, try and come to 3. At the end of the, you know, 10 or 15 minutes before the end of the period, the note taker will have said, look, these are the kind of things I've heard. This is what it sounds like the group is saying. These are the 3 most important things. Then you can say in the group, well, has the note taker got it right? Is this exactly what we want to say to the wider assembly as to what we think are? And you may have a majority, you may all be agreed, or there may be half the group says, no, these are the 3 most important things. There may be a minority report saying, and 2 or 3 of you say, no. The rest of them have got it wrong. These are the most important things. So majority-minority reports coming back to the assembly wouldn't be bad. But if the group can identify those things, then I think we will have gone a long way and you'll be ready to launch right into those key choices next week. So, Alan.
You haven't discussed the flip side of the vacancy issue, which is the MLA recall. How do I recall a list member?
Recall, I don't think, is in our mandate.
It's hugely popular, even though it's ineffective.
It's popular. The mechanism that's been legislated here doesn't seem to work in British Columbia. It would be an interesting if you went for a mixed system and you had some list members and some constituency members. That the recall bill would have to be addressed somehow. But I don't know of any list systems that use recalls. Because you're really not voting for members in ultimate in list systems. You're voting for the list, right? You're not voting for people. You're voting for parties, and the parties are kind of saying, well, this is, if you vote for us, this is who you get. So ultimately, recall is an idea that kind of contradicts the notion of parties, of list systems. Did you have a point, Will?
Yes, Ken. In your cautionary reminders, you say party discipline will not disappear, but in fact, we should be looking for a system that will lessen the impact of party discipline.
Yes. You know, it's a relative notion. I think someone talked yesterday about, might have been Mr. Lunan, I can't remember, about much weaker party discipline in the British Parliament. They have much weaker discipline. Their parties work differently, and people regularly vote against their government. Now, it's easier when you have a parliament of 600 people. You know, if 100 Labour people vote against their government, it doesn't matter because the government still has a majority. But different systems might well have incentives for members to be more independent of party discipline. That's right. It's a relative thing. Electoral systems will make some difference on that continuum. I should say that I've picked these 8 criteria out of that list we've just gone through, but if there are some that your group says we've missed and want to get in, you know, put them in.
Ken, there's quick questions. Julie and RB.
Where's Julie? Julie.
Ken, at the North Shore meeting, Herb Gruhl spoke at length about the increased cost that would be involved if we considered a system that had any element of PR in it. And we haven't talked about that at all. And in your opinion, is this a consideration because it wasn't brought up in any of the comparisons here? And if it is it possible that increased costs of a parliament that would, or excuse me, a legislature that would have more political parties, would it be offset by the inherent advantages of a PR system?
Well, some economists have tried to do some kind of work on this. I'm not persuaded by the kind of studies that we know, we really can say with any kind of assurance. I noted that the Fraser Institute some time ago wrote a piece in the Vancouver Sun in which they said if we were to abandon the constituency system and go to PR, it would be awful for the province. It would cost us this much more. But then, not so recently, they wrote a same economist wrote in the, from the Fraser Institute wrote a piece in the Vancouver Sun saying, well, if you actually moved to constituencies in Vancouver, that would be disastrous because that would cost you more. So, like, there's some tension in that position, eh?
But can you?
I mean, these are really open questions, and the studies that exist are very static. They're kind of cross-sectional. Well, so there's no good evidence one way or another.
But when you're talking about PR, we've always said that PR includes STV. So STV.
Well, there's such a whole range of PR. What does it mean to say PR? I mean, and these studies have kind of said, well, there's two kinds of systems. Well, yeah, but.
Okay, getting down to the pure cost of additional more political parties in the legislature. Is that such a major issue?
I don't think so.
Okay, thank you.
RB, you've been quiet so far this weekend.
Well, I don't think we have enough time to talk today, but I have 2 issues to raise. I want to see your comments. One is fundamental to the whole presentation you made today. The declared or rather stated perspectives on the electoral system. And as the speaker said yesterday, the whole purpose of elections, and as you yourself said, is to form a government or rather to have a legislature to make decisions on our behalf as citizens. Now, these decisions are not only on the declared platforms or rather the issues that they declare beforehand, before the elections, but also any new issues that can come up during the term of office of government. So the fundamental, as a citizen, I would like to use the election to send a representative of mine. That's the whole purpose of democratic model. This is a representative model we are talking about. A representative, not to delegate someone to go and do A, B, C, D. So in that context, I think the perspectives that stated here very much, I mean, I understand, I appreciate. But the biggest to me is to find a system that can send my representative to the legislature who can speak on my behalf.
Okay, sir.
But the second thing I want to raise is the degree of local representation in the STV system compared to other systems, because you had rated that as number one in local representation.
I didn't use the phrase one. I just said it was higher.
I beg your pardon. Yeah, higher. So as I see that, the degree of local representation in STV system is somewhat similar to what we get in a PR system, especially in an open list PR system. So it should go not to the highest point, but somehow towards the lowest point. Thank you.
Well, we could have this debate. I mean, it is true that local representation in STV will work differently than local representation in a single-member district because of the multi versus single-member kinds of districts. But I think that it's fairly even Sharman would agree with me on this one, that there is more of that kind of orientation of members to their local constituents and serving them and paying more attention to them in STV, because in that system, those incentives are much more powerful than any other kind of system.
Ken, there's one last clarification question from Brad.
Clarification on two side issues. Just want to know whether they're going to be outlined in the report. One is regarding ties with some sort of plurality system, where I was on a board where it literally came out 50-50. And they came from a draw of a hat. They actually decided it was actually in the Constitution after 70 years of elections. It was an absolute tie.
Yes, it's another side issue that you have, like vacancies, you have to provide for ties.
And the other one's about recounts. Do we have to detail what happens during recounts?
No.
No.
I don't think you need to worry about that. That will be governed by the courts. And recounts typically happen in certain conditions, and they're just recounting under the existing rules. So I don't think we need to worry too much about that. Well, thank you. I invite you to kind of rank these things, discuss groups, and of course, if there are others you think that, you know, you want to put on there, and they're the most desirable features, by all means.